Hi, this is Jack Tester, and welcome to another episode of Leadership Lounge. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's a bright, sunny January day, and I'm sitting across my desk from one of my favorite people in the world, Julian Scadden. How you doing, Julian?
I am great, and you're one of my favorite people so far, too.
Very cool. Very cool. For those who don't know, Julian's head of operations here at Nexstar and just doing a great job. And I wanted Julian to come on here and kind of tell his journey into and through the industry. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we might have Julian back as another guest to talk about other topics because he's done a lot of interesting things and has got some unique perspective. And I'm interested in it, and I think people listening to this will be interested in it too. But so, Julian, you'd had no family in this business.
No.
No? Why don't you tell us, why don't we start a little further back than this industry and tell us where you grew up and a little bit about your being a young adult.
Yeah, as a young adult, where I grew up in the Mile High City, so that's just outside of Denver, Colorado, and a little place called Commerce City. And, of course, they call it Commerce City because it's all warehouses and dirt roads.
Okay.
These little ranch shanty type of homes, and that's just how we grew up. And, you know, Grandma and Grandpa lived in that neighborhood, and we lived in that neighborhood, and that's it. You know, it's just down the road from all the warehouses. And
so I'm gathering from how you're describing this that that you probably weren't even hardly middle class.
Oh, no. No, this is not a middle class environment.
No?
At all.
Okay.
No. I think if there's a dirtier color on blue collar, that's who we were.
Okay. A dirty blue collar city, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what was it, you know, tell me about, you know, kind of growing up in Commerce City.
You know, the thing that was interesting is that everyone was equal in the way that nobody had anything. But what I do recall, so the fond memories, you don't realize that you don't have anything until you go out and see something else.
Right.
So the fond memories were that everyone had a garden. That's one thing I recall as a young man, that everyone in their backyard, they had rhubarb, they had lettuce, they had tomatoes, and you could just kind of run down the block as a kid, and it was all right to reach right into somebody's garden if you were hungry, and you'd grab a, you know, tomato right there, a cucumber or some rhubarb, and just chew on it. We'd run all up and down those dirt roads and just hang out and have fun.
Okay. Yeah. That's the good memories.
Yeah.
What are some of the bad memories?
Oh, some of the bad memories are, you know, couldn't really have a bike.
Because it kept getting stolen?
Yeah. I remember the first new bike I got lasted about a week, and I knew better. I actually went to visit one of my buddies, left it on his porch, walked inside to just holler his name because I knew not to leave it unattended. I literally stood in the... And again, you know, I've heard the term shotgun homes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially...
You see right through it.
Right. Essentially what this is, I stood in the doorway, hollered, didn't hear a response, so I hollered one more time and walked, I don't know, 5-10 feet into the house. And by the time I got back out, the bike was gone. And there was nobody else even on the street when I walked in. So I don't know how this thing happened.
Oh, you had to be crestfallen.
Yeah. Oh, the first new bike. You know, and I was more upset about having to tell my mother than I actually was about losing the bike.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I perceived her, you know, as really...
But she worked hard for that thing, I suppose.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, and you got a bike, and Julian lost it a weekend.
Just lost it.
Yeah, and I'd
so
lose it.
So careless.
Yeah. You know, just in contrast, you know, I grew up riding bikes. I had Schwinn's.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I'm going to just do the contrast. No one ever stole my bike.
Oh, good for
I
you.
I left it laying everywhere.
Oh, this is fun.
I'm just going to say, so you had a different upbringing than I did, Jay.
Yeah, man.
Right? In fact, we had in my neighborhood, some kids even had their own golf cart.
Oh.
Yeah, that's bringing some contrast here.
Yeah, so there you go, listeners. There's a...
I did not grow up in the mean streets of Commerce City.
No,
that's for sure.
No,
but anyway, I wanna know more about that. So you're a young man. You're becoming an adult. You're in high school.
Mm-hmm.
What was your plan?
There was no plan, and I think that context is fair because it does. You know, this is going to frame some of the early ideology thinking, the way that I would behave as a young man. It was very much about... fortunately, you know, I didn't get into theft. I didn't get into those type of things, but it does create that mentality of I've got to get mine. I've got to look out for number one. You know, I wasn't about looking about helping others. So
that was just that poverty mindset, right?
It is.
You didn't have, so you got to get.
It is.
Right?
It is. It is. So as a young man, you know, I'll jump ahead to about, you know, middle school and give some context here. And it's not to paint a picture. Here's one thing I do want to say early on, for anyone listening here. I was approached once. I was talking with some young folks, and someone in their best nature approached me, and they said, you know, what are your roots? You know, I understand that your background is Native American. You have some Hispanic roots. And it's nice for these other kids to have, you know, this story of either, you know, someone from poverty or someone from that culture. And I said, you know, that's not fair. you can't put that on me to say that I'm the flag bearer for all Native Americans or for everyone who's Hispanic. I said, this is an American story. And the more that I've hung out with our members, it's interesting to me that I'll meet other business owners who are from Alabama, Louisiana, New York, Canada. And they'll say, you know what, I had a very similar experience to you.
Okay.
You know, that I had my own struggles. I've had, you know, right. something similar.
Right.
And that's why I say that to me, and I use the term American, this is an American story. This is a story of a situation. These are just things that you have to overcome. And what I want to talk a little bit about with you too, Jack, is the transformations that I had to make.
I want to hear.
Yeah, there's a ton of angels and grace and blessings that entered my life.
Yeah.
And there's also a lot that I know that I had to put the sweat equity into to make it happen.
Well, you know, Jay, I think that the part that's interesting here is you know, I'll make the contrast between me and you. I grew up in a stable home. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was successful. We had money. I was a member of a country club. You know, mm-hmm. College was my trajectory. You know, I always felt safe. Mm-hmm. Never wanted. I never thought about that. You mm-hmm. know. And here I am, right? Very fortunate, very successful, I think, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, you know, without flaws. But you have, you know, and I think a lot of what's interesting at my point in my life is I look back, you know, you kind of creep to try to find people from way back. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in Alabama years ago.
Yeah.
And so you kind of Facebook stalk some people that you remember that you haven't seen in 35 years.
Yeah.
Right? 50, 40 years, right? And they're doctors, right? They're, you know, attorneys, they're insurance salesmen. You know, I think the people that were in my neighborhood, by and large, some of them are dead too. But I wonder if you went back to Commerce City, if you'd see the same level of success.
Right.
The point I'm getting to, Jay, is that despite the advantages, now, you did not have a lot of the advantages I had.
Mm-hmm.
Yet here you are. And I want to know why you.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Okay.
Why you.
And as contrast, as I looked up one of my old friends the other day,
uh-huh.
I had the privilege of writing him a letter in a federal penitentiary.
Right. Because
that's where he's at now.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that's, I guess that kind of little, cements what I just said.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And this is a guy I grew up with, you know, many of the same things. And to the, you know, to the alternate spectrum, some of the things that I did glean, where I have two cousins as well, same age, and, you know, one of them got a full ride scholarship to an Ivy League school.
I met him.
Right.
Yeah.
Went to Pennsylvania. And the other one pushed himself through. And they're both engineers.
Very cool.
And so, I had those type of people around me, too. And none of us had our fathers around.
Okay.
And so, that's what I want to get back to now
a
young man.
So let's go back.
What happened? So, you know, dad was around when I was a younger man. Mother and father separated and didn't really see a ton of him. So, by middle school, my mother always had MS, and I remember as a young man, there were times when the MS would kick in, multiple sclerosis would kick in, and we'd have to spoon feed my mother, and that was just part of life. And so around middle school, she got cancer, and she fought that off as well. And at this point, I really felt so independent in the way of, you know, this is a woman who put herself through college, would work multiple jobs to take care of my sister and I, and yet I still felt very independent. So there was this always this feeling of, I never wanted to squander any resource she gave me. Her being a college graduate, she always made sure, and I do want to point this out for our listeners, is part of the reason that I sincerely believe my success is that my mother always taught me that there's a name for everything. And the reason that I always remember that is it used to aggravate me. Can I have that? Can I have this? What's that? What's this? What is it called? How do you say it? How do you pronounce it? And I shared a story with Jack once that around this middle school age, my sister is a little bit older than me. She invited some local guys in the house, and they're local gang members. And they're hanging out in the house, and I pull her to the side, and I say, hey, sis, you know, we can't have this. You know, what if mom finds out? No, it's okay. It's okay. You know, they're just eating potato chips. You know, it wasn't anything crazy going on in the house, but it made me nervous. And so one of the gangsters, hey, little man, come here. I say, hey, well, you know, yes. And he says, well, you know, I'm D-Rock. And I put my hand out and I just say, nice to meet you. Look him right in the eye. Nice to meet you. And it's not like I didn't grow up in the neighborhood with these guys, but that's just how my mother had trained us mm-hmm. to interact. And I perceived him as a man because he was older. So anytime I met a man, I'd look him in the eye and I'd shake his hand. I'd say, nice to meet you. If this whole room of gangsters didn't fall out on the floor laughing at me.
Oh, really?
Just the funniest thing they ever heard. You know, so now they're joking, poking each other. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. And old D-Rock turns and he silences the room and he says, this one right here. And he's pointing at me. He says, this one right here. Nobody Fs with this one right here. He's all right. And so for many years, I had this kind of a pass where the guys knew I was different.
Yeah.
Right. Just the way I carried myself, the way I was raised. But they also knew I wasn't a pushover either. You know, yeah. My share of scuffles. And so right around those formative years, I'm having this influence of the streets. I'm having this upbringing from my mother. And then life happens.
Okay. What's life?
So life happens. And right around 16, my mother, between dealing with her illnesses, unable to keep a job, essentially had to move back in with her mother. And there wasn't a place for me there.
Okay.
And I had to find out what I was going to do.
So what'd you do?
I lived out of my car.
Sounds glamorous.
I'd always been a worker. Oh, let me tell you how glamorous this was. So this had to be 92, 93-ish, I think. Okay. 91.
Starting Nextar.
Early 90s. Yeah, that's why, yeah. I want to say that. Nextar's just getting started.
Yeah.
And so am I, in a sense. Because I always worked. And yeah. I always had a job. So that's the other thing, though, is, you know, well, other buddies were out there stealing and running the streets and doing whatever they're doing. I always had a job.
Why did you do that instead of running the
streets? I don't know. You know, outside of the fact that I just sincerely
believe.
Were
you scared of your mom? You didn't want to disappoint your mom?
No, nope. I don't believe that was it.
Wasn't your dad?
I believe I didn't want the consequences. I would watch.
That's wisdom for a young man.
I would watch my friends go in and out of a juvenile hall, and I would hear the way that they would talk about it. And many times, even guys that I knew weren't tough guys, once they went and did that first stint at a juvenile hall, they came back, they had more respect. And I knew they were soft, but they had more respect by doing that time.
Because they
did it.
They did something.
They went and did it. They did something, and they did the time around other guys.
Wow.
And I just did not want that experience. I just did not want the consequence.
Yeah.
I was deathly afraid of, and a lot of those people in there were my other cousins or my friends. And
yeah,
I just didn't want that, though. I was so afraid of what goes on when you lose your freedom.
Wow. That's pretty good. That you had that wisdom.
So it was about the consequence, to be honest with you. It was never about. And the other thing that I believe has served me well is that I believe, for as aggressive as I am and for all the things I believe in, I do believe I have a good heart. Now, in the moment, can I make an emotional decision or comment? Sure.
You do have a good heart. Yeah.
Yeah, but on the inside, it was just.
Back then, too.
I don't want to do that. You know, I
don't want to hurt anybody.
Take from these guys, or I don't want to take from somebody else. Like, we're all poor. Why are we stealing from each other?
Steal from Jack.
I didn't get that. Yeah, I didn't get that.
Yeah.
We were the kids who would, at Halloween, would go to the nice neighborhood because we knew that they gave the big candy bars. And I remember stumbling upon a house that left a giant bowl out of the large candy bars and it said, take one and leave some. And I remember my buddies just dumping that thing out. And even in that moment, I go, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Why would you do that? So I just didn't ever get that mentality.
Wow.
So I'm 16.
So you're 16. You're living in your car.
Living in my car. Always had a job. The reason I mentioned that is because I had this beautiful $500 car, a 1968 Dodge Monaco. So feel free to Google that and look up the four-door version. Because as many of you who have driven old cars know that back seat is a sofa. I mean, we could fit.
Yeah.
20 of us in there if we wanted to, and the trunk
wasn't designed to be a bedroom, though, but go ahead.
But it was.
Yeah, I hear you.
And yet it was quite accommodating.
Yeah.
And so just threw everything I had in the trunk. You know, I had some records and cassettes and some clothes, and put myself through about another 2 years of high school. Really wasn't focused. And so when you asked me earlier, you said, what was the plan? There was no plan. The plan was
survival. Why'd you keep going to high school?
I think part of that was
You weren't made to. Mom wasn't telling you to go to school.
No, there's nobody made. I just felt like it was societal.
Okay.
That if I'm not in school, I'm kind of a, you know, burnout, dropout. Who am I? Like, oh boy. And so I'm not fully fledged, you know, out in the street, fighting, stealing, drug dealing, doing all that stuff. But I'm not fully in school.
Yeah.
So it's like, what are you doing? But if I'm not in school, it felt like I have to fill those hours and then I'm going to be around my cousins who are doing more aggressive things and I don't want to be there either. And there, you know, there were teachers I loved. I was in sports. I was a wrestler. I did well in wrestling for many years. And I enjoyed learning. I've always been a learner.
Yeah.
Didn't enjoy the structure.
That's cool.
I would rebel against that.
Yeah.
But I've always loved learning.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Okay, so I got a few things going here. There was a sense of responsibility. You had a good heart. You know, that however that came to you, you end up with one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You didn't want to be what you saw around the streets.
No.
So you graduated high school?
No.
What happened?
So similarly, just kind of trugging along, you know, teachers tell me you're failing, you're not going to cut it. What are you doing? And they said, you know, you could take your GED. I remember one teacher just pulled me to the side and he said, look, you're a bright kid. I don't know what's going on in your life. You know, I know your cousins and I know you're not doing what they're doing. He says, but you're not even trying. Like a lot of you're not taking the tests. You're not coming to some class, you'll skip a day or two. And I was just doing whatever I wanted, really. because at that time I was working as well. So sometimes I'd sleep in, and other times I just wanted to hang out. And he said, you know, you could take a GED. I said, well, tell me about that thing. Oh, it's down here. It's a two-day process. And something I am proud of that speaks back to the education that my mother embedded in us early, I finished the entire GED test in one sitting. It's supposed to take 2 days in one sitting and, you know, top of the class.
Okay.
It was easy to do.
Were you at like 18 at this time?
Around that time, it was probably maybe 17.
So you just tested out of high school?
Yeah, I just said, if I'm not going to graduate, I'm not going to get the grades. I still had to have the thing.
Okay. All right.
So I just did that so I could go to work more. I said, well, now then, I don't even have to go to this building.
Okay, so you got a GED?
Yeah.
I never knew this.
Yeah.
I thought you at least graduate high school.
Ooh.
No. So naturally, of course, you realize that there was no other option in life other than college, like we tell every kid in America, right? Yeah, so you went to college next, didn't you?
Of course. You know, that GED will get you into the finest.
That was sarcasm, by the way.
Finest accredited universities.
Yeah. It'll get you into some community colleges, all right?
Oh, you know that.
So that's what you did, I'm sure.
And that's the other thing, though. That these, when you're taking the GED, everything they're handing you is to go to this community college to take more of these remedial classes that I couldn't stand anyway.
Okay, right.
And where do I apply this stuff?
Right.
Yeah, so instantly, of course, what I did is there was an old man who lived down the street. He was literally old. Had to be 80s.
Okay, that's old.
And I knew that he owned this plumbing shop, Snake and Rooter, in Colorado. And I just...
He lived down the street in Commerce City?
By now, I've moved to Aurora.
Okay.
So now I've moved to Aurora, which is another suburb.
Uh-huh.
And just went to him. Just said, Harold, I'm ready for a full-time job now.
Okay.
And he said, okay.
He kind of knew you?
Yeah.
A little bit?
He knew me from, you know, up and down the street. And so these, similarly to Commerce City and Aurora, again, I'm in another neighborhood where if you look up and down the street, you know who's doing what. Everybody knows who's doing what. And the reason I chose this street... It's because right around this time, right around 17, my sister had an apartment and my father had reached back out to us. And he lived at one end of the block. My sister lived on the other. And so I would park on that street and I'd kind of sneak into my sister's house, sleep on her couch for a little bit, and I'd get in and out before her kids woke up. And so this guy would see me. And to be honest with you, a few times, or one time I know for sure, I was in my sister's house cooking up something in the afternoon for the kids when they were coming back from school. And I look out the window, and this guy was breaking into one of Harold's trucks. It was, you know, just some young kid was breaking into one of his trucks, just 3 in the afternoon. And I go flying out of her apartment. I go out there, and I sneak around to the driver's side, because what he's doing is he's trying to pull the stereo out. And I'm just watching him. He didn't cut the wires yet, so I'm thinking all this through in the moment, that the radio can still be salvaged. He hasn't done anything that can't be fixed yet. And the guy's down there working, and I just go, hey. And I'm standing right there in the driver's window. Hey. And the guy looks up. And as soon as he looks, as soon as I see his nose turn, right cross, right to his nose, just hit him as hard as I could. And now blood's flying everywhere. I open the car door and I'm just like, come on, get out. You know, I just, get out. And the guy's looking at him, you know, thinking he's about to get a total beating. Get out. Now go on. Get out. I don't want to see you on this block again. You know, this is not what we do around here. And the guy's standing in the middle of the street bleeding. And what I didn't realize is Harold had seen that. And then after that, he came out and he talked to me. He said, oh, you know, thank you for that. So when you say he knew me, that's how, in the type of way he knew me.
That's a pretty good way.
And so, I felt really comfortable.
Asking him for help.
Yeah. I said, I know you have a business. I'll do anything.
Yes.
And his Snake and Rooter, as you might imagine, is plumbing and a lot of drain cleaning. And he handed me a shovel.
Okay.
The first day I went there, I'll never forget it. It sounds like a caricature almost of the situation. But he literally had a spade shovel and just arm fully extended, said, here you go. And I said, okay. I didn't even ask for direct. I said, okay, I took the shovel and stood there. And he goes, oh, you're going to hop on this truck today and you'll do whatever they tell you to do. And I said, okay. And I started digging ditches with the sewer crew. We were digging up lines. And
okay.
That's how I got started in this industry.
Very.
Because almost immediately. Before that, I was a dishwasher and
yeah,
you know, every other horrible job and busboy. And I did insulation. Installation. Yeah, man, fiberglass and all that. Yeah, that's a whole nother story. But yeah, just any kind of labor work I could do.
So how long were you on the sewer crew?
Not long. He was bought out by a major conglomerate.
He bought it by ARS.
Yeah, it was ARS.
This is back in 96, maybe?
Yeah.
95?
Yeah, this had to be the early 90s for sure, mid-90s.
Somewhere in there, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they merged 5 businesses together. And at the same time they did that, everyone was getting reassessed. The man who was going to be the plumbing manager who took over that department just kind of looked at me and said, you know, what service can you run? And at that time, I couldn't run any service. So I was of no value, really. But in talking with me, I'd like to believe this, and over time I learned this, but in talking with me, he looked at me and he said, you know, I don't know that you're a ditch digger.
Okay.
Why don't you come on into the office? I got some work for you.
What'd you think then?
Cool. Air conditioning.
You can work inside. It's air conditioned.
Yeah, yeah, man. So the first thing I did is I might have had $60. And I remember going to something like a Marshall's where you could get a dress shirt for, like, at that time, $10, $12. You know, the see-through white T-shirts. Mm-hmm. They were so poorly made. But it was a dress shirt with a collar. And I go and I grab at least two of those, some undershirts, and go to one of my friend's brothers who worked at, like, J. Crew or something. Because he's the only guy I knew that would probably have some ties. And I just said, I know you've got ties. And he said, yeah, I got a couple. I said, let me borrow one. And so instantly I said, okay, I'm gonna figure out this office thing.
Or the same tie every day.
Every day, man.
Looking sharp.
Recycle
though.
Those shirts, cleaning them in the sink. Nobody else is wearing a tie.
Well, that's so cool that you hadn't. You said you grew up in kind of the dirty blue collar neighborhood.
Oh yeah.
So no one was. You didn't see anybody getting on their truck or getting in their car in a suit and tie.
No.
No.
But I knew that's what I had to do if I was going to be in the building.
Yeah.
And nobody else
there.
How'd
you feel? How'd you feel your first few days walking in that place as an office employee?
To be honest with you, I felt great. I was on top of the world.
Because what were you doing?
This was the big break.
Okay.
This was it.
This was your chance.
I was in. And then, yeah, what I was doing is I got put right instantly in the call center. Again, because I could speak.
Yeah, very articulate. You are. I mean.
And attention to detail. Some of the technicians hated me on their truck because I'd really clean the truck and have all the tools organized before we could take off. Everything had to be a certain way.
Really?
Really.
I can't. For those who don't know, I got to stop for a second and talk about you, Julian. So I go into your office.
Always been this way.
Which is right next to me. And your books are all lined up. They're from highest to lowest, kind of in ascending or descending order, depending on how you look at them. Your office is immaculate. You were just the most organized man. I can imagine you were the ultimate helper.
Oh, God. Yeah, if you like that type of stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah. Otherwise, it gets on your nerves.
I like that kind of stuff.
So they look at these attributes.
Yeah.
Again, look at the articulation, conversation, vocabulary, which wasn't extensive.
No.
But again, to look at me. And so again, at this time, let's paint another picture, Jack. At this time, I'm pretty heavy set. I'm 5'8", and around this time, I'm hovering around probably 170, 180, so I'm chubby. And I've got my beard, and I always edge my beard up kind of as a jawline. You know, you just do that edge right along your jawline. And my hair is fully grown. Never cut my hair until I was in my 30s. So my hair's all the way down my back. And again, when I knew I was going to go into the office, what I did is I had my sister start braiding my hair, as in corn rolls, the braids that stick next to your scalp. And then she tied it in a bun in the back. Because I said, okay, I'm going to be in the office. I need to have my hair above my collar. And so you've got this young, chubby brown man with a pencil-edged-up beard and braids in his tie and his white shirt.
This is clash of cultures, man. This is awesome. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So you did all that.
So I did that, and then so I go into the call center, and you know some of the things that they would have me do, again because of detail orientation, is reorganizing the invoices, you know, just filing things of that nature. Because it would drive me nuts. And I would, if I'm looking for an invoice and I found them out of order, I would say, why don't we do it this way? Why is it chronological? Or why isn't it numerical? Or how could we, you know, and the office manager is just hating me.
Because you're doing his or her job or making them look
because
bad?
I was questioning everything.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I know how they feel.
And so this was a person who like left within a few months of me being there anyway. This was a person who's like the bare minimum type of person.
Yeah.
And the person that they replaced her with is this young black woman. And she was just a rock star, too. And she was my boss. And she was – we were very similar.
Okay.
In aggressive, you know, we want to make it. You know, same – similar in the way that I would watch her wear these – the women's business suits. And I believe she might have had two or three that were ill-cut, meaning that the sleeves would be too long, right, and the pants would be too long.
Right.
You could see it, but she would wear it every day.
Yeah.
And she, I knew her actually because she was a cheerleader at a school across town. So, I mean, she's just gorgeous. She's got the attention of all the guys. You know, the techs do whatever she says. Hey, boys, you know, you got to run these calls. But always carried herself as a professional.
Yeah.
Always carried herself
as a professional. So you looked up to her.
I did. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And she was one of the first advocates I had that spoke up for me. And as she got promoted out of the call center to overall office operations, she said Julian should run the call center. And then after that, I took that position. I had call center and dispatch and Then from there, I got plumbing. So
it's plumbing what? Manager?
Yeah, plumbing service manager.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was during this time when these five companies were being put together, right? How long did that last for you?
I hung out there for anywhere. I honestly forget. It was anywhere from 6 to 8 years. Wow. It was a pretty
from good. When you started at Snake and Rooter in 92 to when you left in 98, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was a pretty good run.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah, for as a young man, I was a career person, and the only reason I left is I had the opportunity. So we had gotten evaluated by what we call the corporate people. So we had the local people, and we had what we call corporate. The corporate people are coming in, and they came in and did some evaluations, and based on performance, the woman that I reported to and myself, I got a recommendation to join a regional meeting, and so we just knew nobody went to these regional meetings without getting some kind of corporate title. And we always looked at these corporate titles as these people were a little bit more protected. So there were certain people in our branch. For example, I could be the plumbing service manager. But our HR and our GM, they would have like the ARS name badge. Their name badges were different. There was some, I forget the distinction, but even in their title, it would carry the corporate name.
Okay.
Where others of ours didn't, it would still say, you know, like... We lost the Snake and Rooter name, but there was another that was called, I'm losing the name right now, but it would have that brand as opposed to the ARS brand. And so we started to look at the people who were starting to get those ARS titles on their names, on their titles. Okay, they were safe. They were getting moving to, and
safe.
A pay raise too. You know, that was okay. The expectation.
So you were going to this region meeting hoping to get a corporate title?
Oh, I knew that's what it was. There's no other reason to go.
You were tapped. This is my big chance.
This is my big chance. Now, let's not forget, though, that this is still, and for the listeners who may recall, let me say this, actually. My mother is a product of the 60s. My mother was very much a part of, and my father as well. Though my father served in Vietnam, it was very much a part of the Cesar Chavez movement, which was about these migrant workers in California and being treated fairly and civil rights. And they're very much, so I not only being educated by my mother, but very much about what's right and what's wrong. And that's probably, now that I say it out loud, I think about why I didn't want to steal from my neighbors. You know, we're all broke and we're all looking to make a living. And she always put this thing in early in me, that community.
Yeah.
Now, as a young man who was homeless, that did turn into more anger. So this turned into I'm being oppressed.
Okay.
The man, you know, I hate society. I was a very, very angry young man. So even though...
Even while you're at Snake and Rooter?
Right.
ARS?
Yeah. So this was all beneath the surface. You know, everyone
this
had
is
to...
This brewing under there. Yeah.
Oh, at all times. And if I ever got slighted, oh, it's because of my color.
Okay.
Oh, it's because of where I'm from. Oh, it's because I don't have a college degree.
Right.
And maybe sometimes it was. But I still carried it as an angry...
Is that why you looked the way you looked? With the ponytail, or is that cultural? Or
well, the hair was cultural. My family being Native, my grandfather and my father, what I saw models, they never cut their hair.
Yeah.
The men never cut their hair. We're of a Cheyenne origin. And my grandmother, you know, all these subliminal things that happen as a child.
Yeah.
And they would talk about the beauty of the warrior man.
I got it.
And you know,
very good.
And when they would say that, we'd go to these powwows, and the way they point, those guys are always the guys with the long hair and the muscles, and they're big, and that was a man's man to me. Yeah. I would see that hair flowing. I'd see them standing erect, and they'd have the booming voices when they would do their chants. And I'd go, that's a man.
Got it.
For me, the man wasn't a suit and tie. To me, it wasn't that. It was more of a physiological dominance.
I got it.
Okay? So, yes.
Yeah.
So now tie that in with where I live, that, heck yeah, you better believe that I was used to having a frown on my face. You know, you go bopping down my street in Aurora. And if any of you want to go, it's off of Colfax. It's a little street called Moline. And it's still pretty much the same. You just go right on by there. And, if you bop down that street with a too big of a grin on your face, somebody's probably going to challenge you. just kind of skipping down the block smiling.
You're an easy mark at that point.
Is one way to say it.
Yeah, so you had a look of toughness.
And it's so deeply ingrained.
Yeah. It's a combination of your heritage and being proud of that. Right.
Part
and
of it.
In the modeling of the males that you looked up to.
Definitely the males that I looked
up
to. But
they didn't have the little... you know, beard around the edge
on the street,
of your
they did for sure.
They did
on the street, they did for sure.
All right,
yeah. I mean, and to be honest, I wasn't even modeling those Native men that I was seeing. I was modeling the men, and I'm going to use that term loosely, that I saw on the block, because most of these guys are maybe 2 to 4 years older than me.
Okay,
because those are the only men that we saw, and most of these guys were the dealers,
right,
and the gangsters and these things.
Okay,
because again, now remember back to an experience where D-Rock said you got to look out for this guy. these are the same guys who are looking out for me, so to speak.
All right.
They wouldn't break in my car because that's all I had.
It's fortunate, man.
Yeah, so I'm protected, and yeah. So I have almost a loyalty to this,
right.
to this culture.
Okay.
All right.
So now we've set the table now. So now we're going to this region meeting at ARS, right? We did a little sidebar there, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Because we got a little context.
Contextual.
Now, it's context that takes us into this meeting because I feel this meeting is important.
It is important. It was a moment where – one of those moments where I made a choice. And this is how I recall it. I can say that it's open to interpretation, but certain facts cannot be disputed. And I forget if it was Dallas or Houston. I just recall that that was our region. We were going down there. I mean, honestly, Jack, as a child, I flew back and forth to New York. I had family there. But this was my first business trip, getting on a plane for business. And,
amen.
You know, wearing my tie when I
so
flew.
So cool.
Just everything.
You're going to get the
hotels
title.
Paid for, the flights
looking
paid for.
Looking fresh. Yeah.
You know, the taxis paid for.
Yeah.
I mean, I've made it.
You know, yes,
this is
you
a
have.
Big deal. And honestly, you know, the other part that adds to the sting of this story is I'm sure telling my mom. You know, told her that I'm.
You're going.
Yeah,
mom's proud.
Oh, my God. You know.
She's proud.
I always knew you'd be all right.
Yeah.
So I walk into this meeting and. What I hadn't realized was the culture and half jokingly and totally honestly, you know, I walk into this room full of men that look like Jack, you know, Jack
look
right
like
now.
Me.
Yeah. They're white men with gray hair and you know, they're in their khakis and their blue blazer. They're wearing the white guy uniform and, you know, they're just joking. They're just having a good time.
I got it.
And I don't think anything of it. You know, I've got my seat at the table. This is cool. And I want to learn how we do it. And I don't recall, because I don't know who it was, to be honest with you, but one individual, one man. Again, remember, I'm walking in with my boss at the time. She's 5'2", light-skinned black woman, gorgeous. Here I come with my braids, and we're both in our best suits at the time. And one of the guys looks up and he goes, oh, the Colorado team. And there's a few other staff with us, too. What's the Colorado team? We go, hey. Oh, you must be. And he calls out the young lady by name and calls me out by name. We say, yes, yeah, hey. It was, well, good. We need some color on the team. And that was his exact comment in this full room. And I remember I was most proud in that moment that I didn't attack him. Like, I seriously wanted to just walk right over and just punch him like he was stealing a radio. I just wanted to give him the one where he knew where I was coming from. And I stood there. And I remember being in paralysis, and I think shock as I reflect on it, because I remember I couldn't move. I remember that so vividly, like I couldn't move. And I think that was for the safety of me and this individual. And I just remember it went blurry, and I got tunnel vision, and I just did an about face, walked out of that room, and went back to my hotel room and sat there fuming. Didn't leave that room until it was time for my flight to go home. I never checked back into that meeting. Nobody ever checked on me.
So you stayed overnight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just
stayed in your room and brooded.
And just...
And got angry. Yeah. And because of the insensitive...
And after that, I never even went back to work. So, you know, that's something that I have to own.
So you flew back and you never even walked back in the
Never even walked back in the building.
Really?
Yeah, never again.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no...
There's no two-week notice there. Huh?
There was no graceful exit there. And one of the most interesting things, and also kind of speaks to my anger as a young man, one of the most interesting things is one of the technicians that I really got along well with popped up at my doorstep 2-3 weeks later. And I see him sitting out there in his uniform in the company truck, and I was mad. What are you doing here? And he says, hey, man, what happened? What's going on? Everybody's worried about you. And then that sentence made me even more upset. Everybody's worried about me, but no one's called me. Nobody's stopped by. Everybody's worried about you. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And I said, you don't have to worry about me. I found something else. You know, again, just being rigid and independent and self-righteous and all those things in that moment.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
That's how I left.
That's how you left. Okay. Wow. That's a, you know, and everybody else probably did people know that? They offended you? Did the woman you were with identify with
this? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And she stayed with him for a period after that. Now, in fairness to her, she did reach out to me. But she gave us some cooling off time. She knew, you know, she grew up in the neighborhood, too. She knew a young, pissed off man needs space.
Yeah.
And that's all she gave me. And, okay. Yeah, we're still friends to this day. Oh. She's not with them anymore. She's doing other things. But she stayed there for a while.
It's funny. You're telling that story, and I can't remember if and when, but it's likely I've said something like that at some point in my career.
Well, yeah.
You know, not just being flip.
Yeah.
You know, maybe even calling out that I'm cool or something too, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't heard that way.
I know, you know what, it's because I'm never on the other side of it.
Yeah.
Right? All I know is my context.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Growing up in a 100% white neighborhood.
And I'm not prepared at that time emotionally to have a conversation. You know, I wasn't even prepared or equipped to say, hey, you know, I didn't like that. Or what did you mean by that?
In a big group.
Yeah.
It's an intimidating group, too.
I don't look like anybody in there.
Right.
You know, I'm already filling out a place, you know.
And it's probably the boss that said that, or the bosses.
Everybody laughed. You know, everybody laughed. It wasn't like it went silent. No one was uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. Except for you.
Yeah.
And maybe your friend
who
was with you. Okay. Well, it's an interesting story and a good lesson.
It is.
Yeah. And for one, for people like me. Right.
Yeah.
And but for folks like you, because, you know, I don't know what if you handle it the right way, if you go back and do it differently, let's not go there, because, you know, that's a different time, a different person. So what happened next for Jay?
So then I swore off the industry. I said, because the other thing that was really great is I did have time there as, you know, a plumbing service manager. And what I didn't realize that I had actually learned, I really learned P&L management.
While you're there.
Yeah. And I hadn't realized that. I'd taken it for granted. And even the things that we do now, like the technician scorecard or the coaching and tracking manager or job costing, like I didn't realize all the things I had learned. That's just what I was.
Okay.
I had pride in my work and those were what I was supposed to do. So I learned all that. I learned all these operations. I went off on I found a job with a food distribution company. And that's when I realized how much I actually knew about operations.
Okay.
Went there, call center rep. You know, I knew I could get a job quickly.
Yeah.
Call center rep, you can get that job anywhere. So I went there, and then as I was looking over, again, looking at some of the orders and invoices and started questioning the manager there.
They weren't organized, right?
Yeah. And she turns me over to the operations manager, said, you know, Julian's got some questions that I can answer. And a really nice guy at that time. And he just goes, man, you know, what have you been doing? And, you know, he kind of pulls me, again, because at a glance, from my interview to me walking in that building every day, if you looked at me, people were probably just saying, let's just make sure this guy is instilling stuff. You know, that's just how I looked. I had a mean face. You know, I had a bad posture, you know, and then he said, where you been? Where are you from? What do you know? And I started to learn that business. So that happens. And then I run into one of the people who was a real advocate for me at ARS. His name is Ed Coleman.
Yeah.
And he had worked there with me and he had left. And I didn't know, though, that he had left and started working at Plumline.
Which Nexstar
member. Nexstar member.
Yeah.
And bumps into me at a gas station, and he's this loud, boisterous guy, for those of you that didn't know him. Big 6'6", big old hunting, fishing, mustachioed, boisterous guy. And, hey, Julian! And as soon as I heard it, I knew who it was.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to see him. You know, he really taught me a lot. He actually, and I'm going to use this term, set me up to be the plumbing manager. He had me run a lot of his reports. He had me do a lot of his work for a period during that transition and acquisition. And I was very resentful to him for a period. And as soon as we got the assessments, as soon as the corporate guys came in and were assessing all of us, they go, oh, you're the service manager.
Okay.
Because I knew all of that stuff. And then I realized what he had been doing. Hey, Julian, what are you up to, man? I said, oh, you know, I'm doing this thing, food distribution. Oh, okay, you got to come work with us. And I said, what are you doing? You remember old Jeffy Bell? Because Jeff had actually worked in one of the businesses in the back of the building that had been acquired.
His family had sold their business at the ARS too. Yeah.
So yeah, we were all kind of incestuous in that way in the industry.
Yep.
And I remember him. Yeah, he started this thing. Come check it out. And I go, well, is it in the industry? Yeah. We're plumbing, we're heating and cooling. Oh no. I know what it takes to win in that business. I'm not going back. And what I meant by that is, you know, the model that I had seen is we had over 200 technicians at the ARS location at that time. And I mean, we just ran these guys into the dirt. It was instilled in me from upper management at that location that, you know, I don't care what they say, give them one more. I don't care what the customer says. And until they have a lawyer, we don't give them a penny back. And, you know, you run these guys until you can't run them anymore and you never give a penny back to the customer. And I said, and I saw the money that we made and I go, I know what it takes to win in this game. And
it's not me.
I don't align with it.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
And at the time, the food distribution company I was working with was family owned. So again, I'm getting this small feeling and I can see the owner every day. And he's this wonderful Italian American who's almost stereotypical. He's got the big mustache and giving us turkeys and wine on Thanksgiving and riding his Harley with Italian flags on the back of it on Columbus Day. And he's just a mess. And he was great.
Yeah.
An amazing guy. So I'm not walking away. But I did.
Okay.
Because I respected Ed and I wanted to go see what these men had built. And went to work with them, started call center, you know, CSR, you got to start as a CSR, Julian. Okay. Yeah. And they sent me to my first Nextstar training.
Okay. What was it?
It was call center.
All right.
Call center. And I said, what the heck is this? What's going on? And I think I could be wrong. I think it might have been Bob Hamilton leading that class.
Okay.
And probably Sherry.
Sherry Benefield.
Because I recall it was a man and a woman running this class. And again, for my taste, I felt it was a little hokey.
Okay.
Like, this is a little goofy. Just give me the stuff.
Right.
Because there was all this talk at your table and see what your neighbor thinks.
Table
and
toys.
Right on the wall. Yeah. And play with the toys. I'm like, just give me the stuff.
Yeah.
Just tell me how to be good.
Right.
But by the end of the third day, as we see now, had made a bunch of friends.
Yeah.
Learned a lot and was really excited. And, you know, I'll even say that, you know, Jeff, as the owner of the company, and he had a right-hand man, John Heggie, you know, they taught me a lot. They're ones that I was really – I believe the reason that I was open to the coaching that they gave me and the development that I actually – I knew a lot of business. When I got there, I did know a lot of business savvy and sense and operations. But I didn't have the personal development still yet.
Yeah.
And John more than Jeff, and that's only because Jeff worked through John – would pull me to the side and have conversations with me and challenge my thinking at times and ask me where I was coming from and get to know about me. And similarly, you know, things like at this point in time, I had my first son when I was 19. So now by this time I'm a father and, you know, I'm providing. And they would do things. I'll never forget this. Jeff pulling me into his office one day and he said, you know, hey, how are things going? Everything's great. You know, what does he want? Why is the owner calling me into his office?
Yeah.
It's football season. Yeah. And I heard you coach your son's team. Yeah, I sure do. He says, okay, well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write down the practices that you absolutely cannot miss and the games that you absolutely cannot miss. You know, your current schedule, I can't promise that you'll get to every practice and can't promise you'll get to every game. But if you'll really look at that calendar, you'll decide what you absolutely cannot miss. If you get that to us, we'll help you with your schedule.
Okay.
Just that gesture right there, I was confused. I'd never heard anything like this.
Okay.
Wow, this guy's acknowledging I actually have a family.
Right.
And he's treating me with respect. He's not looking at me like, you know, some young punk who had a kid. And, you know, he's just talking to me.
Uh-huh.
Hey, this is what's important to you. Let's figure it out.
Yeah.
That, and then they sent me to training. So all of these things started to open me up. I saw the investment in me. And now I have an ear for when they would challenge me or correct me or say, again, so again, being young and knowing operations, even though I could say that the old way of ARS, I didn't like it. Being young and wanting to prove myself, I'm sure I came into plumb line very aggressive initially with some of my coworkers and staff. Okay, we got to get this number. We've got to get it. We've got to drive. Yeah. We've got to.
Yeah.
And they were very, they invested in me to challenge some of that thinking. Say, how could we do it differently?
Right.
How could you collaborate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. So you got back in the industry.
Now I'm back.
Now, Julian, I'm gonna push forward a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I want to talk about this a little bit.
Yeah.
You ended up in Atlanta.
I did.
As an operations manager for a Nextstar company, which is where the first time I met you.
Yes.
So you just quickly tell us how you got to Atlanta.
Yeah, let's really quickly talk about that because this is one of the stories that I share, and people say I've had a similar experience. So whether being homeless or whether being in a rough neighborhood, all of these things, these are real American stories. Okay, it's not.
Yeah.
There are some demographics that see it more frequently, I believe, or systemically, but that's another conversation.
Uh-huh.
So what's happening at this point in time? I'm working at a plumb line, and man, I'll never forget this. For a year, my son and I, because I'm raising my son, it's just the two of us. I'm his sole provider. He's living with me, and I'll remember. For a year, I had this plan, and I called it the sandwich plan. I said, son, we're going to eat chips and sandwiches for a year to save enough money to get a house. But that was to rent a house. You know, okay. I wasn't thinking buying.
Right.
But if I could just rent one of these shotgun houses, because again, as you go down Moline from all the apartments that I lived in, then you get these shotgun houses at the end. And I go, I'm going to get us a house, son. I'm going to get us a house. And here's the plan. And I did it. You know, fortunately also, though, through Plumb Line promoting me and developing me and giving me more money. So what happens is one day my son and I are just got back from football practice, whipped up spaghetti, turning on a movie. And I hear my screen door open, and again, the house isn't huge, so I look to my left, and there's two guys standing right there that I don't know. And I say, hey, guys, you know what's going on? And two guns come out.
Oh, man.
Two guns, right? You know, they pull a gun out, and my son's sitting right there. Now, my son, maybe around this time, I don't want to exaggerate. I don't recall exactly, but maybe 12 years old. And they pull a gun out, and so I start walking straight towards the guy, and he puts it right to my head. And I don't know what the second guy did. He kind of motioned like he was going to raise his gun towards my son. And I don't know, whatever I did, the lead guy says, hey, don't point the gun at the kid, because I'm sure my physiology changed.
Yeah.
And I said, instantly, I said, hey, guys, I don't know what you're looking for, but you've got the wrong house. Home invasion, whatever they were looking for. You know, they went through the whole house. They held us at gunpoint. They turned the house upside down. I don't know what they were looking for, but they had the wrong house. At that moment in time, and I'm going to be very direct here. I did have a thought that night. You know, I called my son's mother, who I want to be very clear, she wasn't absent. You know, yes, we're just doing what we had to do.
I understand.
And I said, Nate needs to come over tonight. She says, okay. And I didn't tell her why at first. She just said, okay. And that night, I just remember sitting in that house and mourning the loss. And I don't want to say of innocence, but the fact that I had got the house, I had made it, I had this good job, but I just still wasn't far enough away. And I mourned, I cried, I was a mess. I mean, just like really like sobbing, like the heavy breathing, like a child does, yeah, where they can't even talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, in all honesty, I did have a gun in the house. And I just kept thinking, I had a reoccurring thought. Either I have to kill them or they're going to kill me because they didn't wear masks when they came in, which is very bizarre.
Okay. So you knew who they were.
And I'd never seen them before.
Okay.
But that's the reoccurring thought now. This is my mentality being in the streets, that they know who I am.
I get it.
And so they know I'm either coming for them, and if I come for them.
Your son knows
them too. Exactly.
Yeah.
And my son walks to school every day right down the same block.
Oh, boy.
Right? The school's only a few yards away. So this is the reoccurring thought. Kill or be killed. They're either coming to finish the job now, they just didn't want to do it in front of my son, or I have to kill someone. And I remember then. So the next day I go to Nathan's mother's house and I say, I need to stay here for a while too. And then I told her what happened. And she says, of course, you guys, we'll figure it out. You know, we're all on the couches. We'll figure it out. And I remember walking across the street, and across the street from her apartments, there's this, you know, the mega Walmart. And I think it's called a Good Times. It's a burger place. And I'm sitting out there, again, just crying.
Yeah.
Just mourning the loss.
Sure.
My life is over. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And, it's dusk. And this car pulls up, and I don't even know why I'm thinking this way, but this car pulls up, the headlights are on me, and I'm sitting outside, these little benches outside, and the headlights just stay on me a little too long, and I'm going,
oh, here it is.
This is it.
Yeah.
This is it. This is the guys.
Yeah.
And I don't have a gun on me. And I go, well, I'm not just going to stand here and take it. You know, I'm going to run. I'm going to fight. I'm going to do whatever I have to do. But I remember that feeling, because what I had resolved to the night before, right before I went for that walk, as I resolved in my heart, I said, I'm not going to kill anybody.
Okay.
And it's bizarre, but I like, these are the little thoughts I'm having in my head. You either have to kill or be killed. And then a few hours later that next morning, I go, I'm not going to kill anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah. Because I'll die first. Yeah.
And because if I do that, then somebody's coming for me. I'm like, right. Now it's a cycle. Right. Now
you're really,
I know where this goes.
Yeah.
Cause I've seen it happen in the neighborhood. So I said, these headlights are on me. I get worked up. The headlights go off. Two elderly people. And they're just helping each other out the car as slow as they can. And now I'm feeling like an idiot. And I go, am I going to live this way the rest of my life?
Right.
And so, and I'm getting where we're going, Jack.
No, you're doing great.
They hop out and I watch this moment. They go to, the man sits down at a bench just across from me. The woman goes to the window and she orders the smallest ice cream cone, a small vanilla ice cream cone.
Yeah.
And she comes back and they share it. She takes a look, he takes a look, and they're just sharing it. And I remember this so vividly that I looked at their beat up old car and I looked at them and I said, look how poor they are. Look how poor they are. They have this beat up car. When I'm that age, if I have a beat up car and I have to share an ice cream cone with my wife, I'm a failure. And I thought that. And in that same moment, I broke out in tears because I went, they're richer than me.
Yeah.
Because they have their freedom. They're not right. Looking over their back.
Right.
And it, almost in an instant, it shifted from they're so poor to I hope I can be as rich as them someday.
Yeah.
If I could just walk down the street and I have to think about, like they're rich. It happened in an instant. And as soon as I did that, I said, the only way out of this is I have to leave.
I can't get out of this.
Far enough away.
Yeah.
So I honestly left everything in the house. I had a buddy of mine who I explained to him what happened. I said, look, I'll pay the rent, you know, up through the rest of this period. You know, would you kind of help me out or whatever, you know, and I felt that was the honorable thing to do, but just took my clothes. And then my cousins that I mentioned earlier, both of them had moved to New York. So the one that did, went to, Pennsylvania University, and then the other one had found himself out there in a job. And I just said, I got to come to New York because that's where my family always was. Yep. I traveled back and forth. So I just said, I got to come out there. I'll do anything. and all I had was my clothes. And I went out there and I got into like this boiler room type of sales. And I figured I'd push through, I'd persevere, I can make it. You know, if I can make it in New York, yeah. I'll make it. I couldn't stand it. I'm not a salesy guy.
Right.
I'm not that aggressive. I didn't like what they were doing. It was underhanded what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I lasted maybe 3 months.
Okay.
Maybe 3 months. And being the person that I am, what I did is I had these cards from all the Nexstar members I had met over the years at events, at groups. And I'm serious. It was a stack of a good 20 to 30 business cards that yeah. I always kept. And so I thought, because I knew I didn't want to raise my son in New York. I knew that I was just going to go there to figure things out for a moment. I just had to get away. And so my core thinking was my son at this point, even in middle school, was being sought after for his athleticism, that he had the potential for scholarships for football.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, where do I want to put him in school? And I landed in either somewhere in the South or in California. And then as I started to call members, I started to call members in Florida, called a guy in Atlanta, and called a couple people in California, Southern California. And I had an opportunity, I don't even recall who it is right now, but there was somebody in California and he was close to Long Beach. And I saw that there's Long Beach Polytech, which is a school where Nate could definitely get seen if I got him there. And then I looked at where, for what they were paying and for where I'd be living, that I would just be right back where I was.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that.
You'd be back in the hood. So
oh,
to speak.
Man. Yeah. I didn't know what it costs to live in California.
Right. Right.
And so I started looking at the time that it would take for me to get out of the hood in California. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about the South. And the guy in Atlanta was very aggressive. He's like, come out, come see me. We'll get this thing started. And I get out there and you know, he's doing well. And I see the South and I'm checking the prices that I could afford. And I go, this is nice.
Like, I can make this work.
I can make this work. And it's schools that I know my son will be seen. I know the football's year round out there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, that's the story of
getting to
how I left and ended up in Atlanta where you met me.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about that because I think it's interesting because I think it's going to tie back to a lot of what you've talked about so far.
Yeah.
So this company and the company was Allface mm-hmm. in Atlanta. And the owner called me and I was a business coach at this time. And he said, Jack, come on down. I want to have you help me with my business. I'm excited to move this thing forward. And I think they were plumbing and just started heating and air conditioning. A lot of different things going on in that business, right? And very, yeah. very, very extra. You know,
he was built on new construction. Yeah, so that was right. part of the, I came down to help him. Part of my pitch to him was, I said, I can build your residential department.
Right.
I know how to do that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to touch that new construction. I don't want to know anything about it. Right. You can have that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so I roll in the business and he tells me ahead of time, he says, you got to meet Julian. Julian's this great guy who's working with us. In fact, we're going to have dinner with Julian some of these nights too, so you'll get to know him and his help me with my business. So I roll into the company, right? And I'm the business coach. I got a suit and tie on.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And you probably remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's, and your desk was in the middle of the office.
Everything. Like, an open office.
An open office. So you visualize I'm going to guess a 20 by 30 foot room, and your desk was in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And there's people around it. And I met you, and you were huge.
Yeah, by then, now I'm over 200 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't like sloppy fat, but you looked like a deadlifter
yep.
or something. Or
yes.
a rock breaker or whatever I'm thinking of right now.
That's,
right?
That's the body.
So you're a big, heavy set guy with like big shoulders, and you couldn't put your arms straight across your body because your body was so wide and your arms were big. And you had this massive ponytail.
Yep.
And I didn't know what Julian
this
would
look
like.
This is the Julian.
This is the Julian I'm seeing, right? And of course, my context. Again, even in this industry, Julian, I will say this, that you know, I came into the industry in 85. I grew up in a upper middle class home. Mm-hmm. You know, literally in my grade school in Alabama, there was one black man in the school, and he was a teacher's kid.
Yeah.
There was none, right? Yeah. I didn't grow up with any.
Yeah.
You know, never played with young people of color at all,
yeah.
right? And then I moved to Milwaukee, and it was just as white, right? Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right? Then I went to college at Duluth.
Oh,
Duluth,
yeah.
Minnesota, you know, it was couldn't have been whiter, right? Yeah. There's natives there, but it couldn't have been whiter. And in this industry, from started in 85, this is an entirely, especially in Minnesota, was entirely Anglo industry.
Yeah.
So by this time, of course, I you know, worked with some folks. And but I saw you, and it definitely was like, whoa, what's this, right? And then I remember we had... I don't remember anything else about the day. Can I share this, Julian?
Oh, I'm sure I know where you're going.
Yeah. You were on the phone with somebody, And you were yelling on the phone.
At the top of my lungs.
At the top of your lungs. Don't you disrespect me. Don't you say I said that. It was real. I've never experienced that as a coach walking into a call center. And I'm seeing this man come unglued on the phone. That was you.
Yeah.
And then we were over at Mark's house.
Do you recall what I said as soon as I hung up?
No.
As soon as I hung up, the exact, and maybe you didn't hear it, but the exact words out of my mouth, because I remember fuming and staring at that phone and saying, it doesn't even matter what he just said to me. I'm the fool.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
Because I knew that he had pulled me in, and it didn't even matter what he said to me. As far as everyone in that room, I looked like a complete idiot. Because I was, I mean, top of my lungs.
You were screaming.
If he had been in person, we would have had to been separated for what he said to me.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that at that level in a long time. Anyway, so then we go to Mark Davis's house, who's the owner of All Faiths. And we had dinner, and you come over for dinner, and now this time you had your ponytail up in a bun, I remember that. And he said, Julian, will you lead us in prayer? and you had this most eloquent prayer I'd ever heard in my life, right? It was just amazing what you were doing, and I thought, this is an articulate, thoughtful man, right? And that's not the impression I got of you walking in that business.
No way,
right?
No.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's interesting. So, What I want to go to now, so that's my impression, right? And then we started working together as a business coach and you as the operator, and I think we had a pretty decent relationship there for a year or two as the business. And the business struggled, and ultimately you left the business.
Yes.
Right.
Yep. But we did great. I do want to park there, Jack.
You did great.
With the guidance that you gave and the action that we took, we really did. We grew that business. It did really, really great. It was just, you know, as far as Leadership Lounge, this speaks to dysfunctional leadership teams. There's no amount of money, revenue, or profit that can fix dysfunction and lack of health. And I've seen it firsthand.
Well, that's right, because your business, you know, I'm not going to point fingers here, but it was a dysfunctional leadership team there at your business. And what I recognized in you is you were trying to keep it together. Mm-hmm. And I remember conversations with you, Julian, at the time. I said, Julian, this is where you're going to show what you're worth if you stay through it.
Yep.
And be a man of integrity as you work through this. Because I remembered, you know, the parallel I had in my life was I remember when ARS was being sold.
Okay.
And I was a leader in that business. And it was really easy to check out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we knew that the current leadership team would be gone.
Right.
And, you know, so whatever we did in that interim period really didn't matter.
Right.
Right. So you could cut out, you could, you know, no one was holding anybody accountable. It was just, you're playing out the string. Right. And I remember watching certain people at the business live into that and do be a good employee, and certain people take advantage of the situation. So I remember thinking about that as I watched you, and you didn't take advantage of the situation. You were the adult in the room, is what I saw.
and I want to add on to that and say for the listeners, even though I have a good heart, even though by nature I had that ethic, it still did me a world of good to hear it.
Okay.
So even make sure that, you know, with your great employees and the people that you love, there's no harm in reaffirming the attributes and characteristics, because that would be fuel for me. Because again, I'm looking at Jack as a successful person. For him to say that, there would be days where my energy was low and I would think, screw it, I can leave. I'm just going to, you know, nobody else is here.
Right.
I'll cut a lower. I've put in more hours than anybody in here anyway.
Right.
Let today be my day. And then I could replay in my head and say, what am I going to be most proud of?
Yes, you'll look back on this and feel good about it.
And then now sit on this podcast and say, I picked that weight up one more time when I was tired.
Right.
I walked one more mile when I was tired. And there's a pride that goes with that, for sure.
Yeah. So that, and I recall that feeling I had too. So I'm glad that, you know, so it was thinking back on that, you know, you really showed yourself well in that transition. And then it finally came to an end there at All Faiths, you know, when you decided to leave.
Yep.
And the business was in a position where it could even afford a person like you, right? So you left. And you called me up and said, I want to be a coach, Jack.
That's right.
You called me and you said, I want to be a coach. You didn't say like me, but that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking the world of you, but thinking you didn't have enough experience. And I didn't know. I thought you just worked at All Faiths. I didn't know, you know, just listening to what you've been through right now, it's like, wow. I probably underestimated you a little bit, but I didn't think you had
I don't sell myself well. I have to own that.
You're a lousy salesman. I'll say that right now. But I didn't think you could be a business coach. And, of course, the only coaching positions we had at that time were business coaches.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
And, you know, you hadn't really been a single GM, and, you know, I was looking for a certain profile, and I didn't think you fit it at the time. Mm-hmm. So we slowly lost touch of each other.
And even again, as I looked at that bench, what they looked like that we had here at Nextdoor at the time, I said, I don't look like that. And to be honest with you, my patience in thinking, even when I called and told you that, I didn't expect anything but time. And I always have felt like in my life, I will have the time. One of the first things I did is I went out and I created a free website.
Right.
I started
Coach Julian.
Coach Julian. And I started to continuing ed classes with my local PHCC. And what I would do is I did a monthly email, and Jack was one of the people that I had copied on that list. So as I was building my coaching clientele there for a couple years in Atlanta, I made sure that he was still on that list. And I said, I know that he perceives me as not ready yet. And I believe a part of me didn't feel ready, which is why I wasn't aggressive.
Yeah.
I said, I feel like I did want more experience.
And you're not a good salesman either.
I'm not.
Yeah.
No, I'm pretty easy. So I said, I'm just going to go out and get the experience.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go out and show him that I am a coach.
Right.
And so that's part of what I did for a couple years as well.
So I'm going to begin to wrap up with just how we kind of became reacquainted, because I think I want to share my story there too.
Cool.
So business coach didn't feel was right for you, and several years later, we had this idea to create this training accountability program. Mm-hmm. This idea that we wanted to create a coach position where we could help the managers of people who send folks to training make sure that they're following up on that training to make sure the training that we give, the behaviors we teach, actually gets used in the field with customers where it matters. We saw this huge drop off. They love the training, but then they go home and then they don't do what we train all the way, and then it falls off. So we wanted to create a position to do that. So it was kind of junior in some respects to the business coach. Very, very important. But you know, it'd be working with service managers, it'd be working with installation sales managers, those kind of people, we thought. So I remember, this is brand new, you know, we didn't create the position with anyone in mind. We just said, well, this was a need, and let's go out and figure it out. So I remember I was sitting at my desk with Scott Pearson, and we were thinking about who could be this first hire. Mm-hmm. And I was just going through kind of who I remembered, and I said, Julian Scadden. Maybe we could talk to Julian. Mm-hmm. And I remember telling Scott, now this is transparently sharing this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he's really got long hair. He really looks rough. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a smart guy. Let's see what he's doing in life. So I remember I Googled your name, and I came across this still active but essentially dormant website, Coach Julian. Mm-hmm. And I left a message on the – you could go to the site, and it just said leave a message, and I typed a message in. Hey, yep. Julian, you want to talk? Right? And, like, the next day or later that day, you must have still been monitoring that thing.
Oh, that's right.
And you saw my name, and you reached out. So we talked. And I remember I was talking to you, and you were working for the Department of Motor Vehicle Services in Georgia at this time.
Yeah, I had picked up an operations position, was running their motor vehicle department.
I bet you ran it well, too. But anyway.
Over almost a million people in that county.
That's amazing.
8 different locations.
Okay.
Proud of that.
You did. You did a good job, right? And I said, Julian, would you be interested? I explained the role, and you said, I'd be very interested, right? And then I said something that I've since really regretted. Right, because I didn't know context.
Yeah,
and I said, Julian, I have to ask, do you still have the ponytail?
Yep.
And you said, no, I didn't. Tell me how you felt when I said that, and I'll tell you how I feel after the fact.
Yeah, I honestly, when you asked that question, everything in me wished that I still did.
Yeah,
I just wanted to say yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
But you cut it.
I had. That
and
was
you cut it for locks of love.
Locks of love. I had made a joke, but so really talk about fast forwarding onto the fourth child we had just had. And oddly or interestingly enough, his name just happened to be Samson. And when we were looking for baby supplies, then the other thing we saw was Locks of Love. And I learned what that is, where you can donate your hair to make wigs for children who have survived cancer. And the brilliant husband that I am told my wife that someday I'll do that. And it was literally the next day I was driving to a job site, one of our locations. And there was a detour, and I had to go off the beaten path. And there, I passed by this little salon, and it said Locks of Love right on their on their marquee, and I go, oh boy, that's a sign. So I did it, and then I realized having short hair is very low maintenance, and I've never gone back.
Yeah. but what I, you know, all I thought of was, you know, you didn't look like the rest of us.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, how would our members react to this hulking guy with a big ponytail down his back? Mm-hmm. I had no, I'm not making excuses for myself, but I didn't even consider that this was anything other than a tough look,
mm-hmm.
not a cultural look, mm. that it was identifying with the people that you looked up to. It was identifying with your native culture, mm-hmm. all these other things that I know, you know, as soon as I said it, you could have done exactly what you did at the ARS meeting.
Hung up softly
and sat in your room and stewed for a day and a half.
Yep.
And, you know, and, you know, with context, I'd like to think I wouldn't ask that question again because, you know, the character you was, I think I told you later, mm-hmm. I like to believe it was true that I hired you anyway.
After you knew you had me, yeah, because you are a good salesperson.
Yeah. I like to think I'd hired you anyway, but I regret the question. How's that? I regret the question.
That's fair.
You know.
That's fair.
And you like to learn from things like that. And hopefully, you know, that folks listening here will consider that story as maybe something they can learn from as well, on both sides of it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, that's an interesting journey all the way to Nexstar. We're going to have another podcast. We're going to talk about your current role and kind of how that interacts with my role, because I think that's going to be interesting for members as they grow their business, because we've been working through some things here ourselves.
Yeah, I'm very, very proud and privileged of the work that we have done here, and grateful. Just want to say for everyone who's had their journey, whatever their story is, this is not to glorify anything that I have been favored to overcome. Just aware and grateful for all of the guideposts that have helped me through it, and share all of this to inspire you all to simply know that you're greater than you ever thought you were, and as there are people that you see struggling, when they're ready to meet you for that help, to extend that hand, but never charity, meaning that those who will meet you halfway will do the work with you, and those are good people, and I appreciate everybody who met me halfway and helped me get here.
Well, you told a story about meeting a lot of people halfway, your manager at ARS, this mm-hmm. owner of Snake and Rooter, Ed Coleman, Jeff Belk, Mark Davis, a lot of people along the way helped you out. Right?
They did. They sure did.
You know, but you're worth helping for sure. So congratulations, Julian, on
cool.
your journey through this industry. It's a fascinating story. There's 50 lessons in that for people that are willing to listen and apply.
Hmm.
And I've learned a lot of things. I've worked for you a lot of years, and I learned some things on this call that I didn't know, and I appreciate that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And we thank you all for listening to this really, really good episode of Leadership Lounge. This is Jack Tester with the amazing Julian Scadden, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.